miracle victory. He was unhappy with himself for the interception. But he knew he had played well, 22 of 32 for 290 yards and 3 touchdowns, coming in cold after Winston had gotten hurt and after a 9-month hiatus. "That was the day when I really knew I'd done the right thing coming back for another year," he said. "I had signed because the opportunity was there, and I honestly wasn't sure what I'd do next when I stopped playing football. To be able to go back to where football began for me, to get into the game when I hadn't really expected it and play well, was very emotional for me. It wasn't perfect, and the ending was kind of flat, but I felt I had proved to myself that I still belonged in the NFL. That was a very good feeling." The next day, sitting in the quarterback's meeting talking about the game, breaking down what had gone right and had gone wrong, Fitzpatrick was surprised when he heard a catch in his voice as he talked about some of the plays he'd been able to make. "Next thing I knew, I had tears in my eyes," he said. "It caught me off guard. That's not me. I don't get emotional like that. In fact, I kind of looked down and said, 'What is this stuff coming out of my eyes?' I realized that being a football player has meant a lot to me, and being able to kind of put the nightmare that was 2016 behind me, not by walking away from it, but by playing well again, was a big deal." The question, then, was Winston's status for the following week in Buffalo. His injury had been diagnosed as a mild sprain of the AC joint. It hurt, but Winston and the team doctors believed he could play through it and that he was no more at risk for a serious injury than he would be playing completely healthy. Fitzpatrick got plenty of reps in practice that week, and all sorts of stories flew around the internet and the various weekly football shows that the Fitzpatrick jinx lives. By Sunday, Winston was ready to play, and he played well, completing 32 of 44 passes for 384 yards. If his shoulder bothered him, it didn't show in his throwing. A late turnover, however, doomed the Bucks. Steven Hauschka making a 30-yard field goal with 14 seconds to go for a 30-27 Bills victory. The Bucks had now lost 3 straight to drop to 2-4, the total margin in those 3 weeks being 13 points. Winston was the starter again the following week at home against the Carolina Panthers, but this time the Bucks mustered little offense in a 17-3 loss. And a week later in New Orleans, they cratered. It began with a bizarre pregame pep talk from Winston. Standing in the middle of his offensive teammates on the field before warmups, he implored them to eat a W, forming his fingers as best he could into a W and then sticking them in his mouth repeatedly. He was met by confused looks from everyone. Clearly not fired up, the offense sputtered again, and Dirk Cutter decided to pull Winston at halftime with his team trailing 16-3. Winston had taken another hit on his shoulder while being sacked in the second quarter, but insisted there was no more pain than he'd had since the initial injury. Fitzpatrick started the second half, but couldn't find the magic that had been there in Arizona, in part because he never really had a chance. The Saints scored twice quickly in the third quarter, once after taking the kickoff, then again after an O.J. Howard fumble. That made it 30-3. On the next series, Fitzpatrick tried to find DeSean Jackson running down the left sideline, but rookie cornerback Marcus Lattimore had him well covered, and Fitzpatrick threw the ball over both their heads. Suddenly, as Lattimore started to return to his huddle after a brief celebration of his coverage, Winston came off the bench behind him, poking his fingers not into his own mouth, but into Lattimore's helmet, shoving him in the process. Lattimore turned on Winston and shoved him back. From out of nowhere came Mike Evans piling into Lattimore. A brief melee ensued, and it ended with Evans only called for unnecessary roughness. A day later, after looking at the replay, the NFL handed down a 1-game suspension. The rest of the game was pretty much playing out the string. The Bucks scored late to make the final 30-10. Things didn't get any better the next day. An MRI on Winston's shoulder revealed a bunch of medical terms I can't pronounce, Cutter said. The bottom line, the doctors wanted Winston to rest for at least 2 weeks. At the very least, that would give him time to calm down and work on his pregame speeches. Cutter readily admitted that he was furious with both Winston and Evans for the incident on Sunday. "You just can't do that," he said of both players' behavior. Then he was asked for the mood of the team, now 2-6, with its star quarterback out for at least 2 games and its best wide receiver out for 1. Frustrated, upset, disappointed, Cutter answered. Pretty much what you'd expect from a team that started with high expectations and is 2-6. The starter the following Sunday would be Ryan Fitzpatrick. The opponent would be the New York Jets. Naturally, the twists and turns kept coming. After the Philadelphia Eagles had gone into Washington and opened the season with a somewhat surprising victory, the naysayers in D.C. had a field day. This has become a fall tradition in the nation's capital in the last 20 years, in part because even the most loyal fans of the team can't stand owner Dan Snyder. Snyder is the poster boy for rich guys who think that having a lot of money, regardless of how it's acquired, makes you somehow better than other people. According to one former employee who worked in Snyder's house, she was handed a list of rules after being hired that included an admonition to never look Mr. Snyder in the eye when speaking to him and to leave any room he walked into unless Mr. Snyder needed her to fulfill a task. That wasn't what bothered most fans. Losing bothered them. And Washington, which had won 3 Super Bowls under the ownership of Jack Kent Cook and the stewardship of general manager Bobby Bethard and coach Joe Gibbs, didn't win very often. Early on, Snyder tried to sign every big-name free agent he could find, if only so he could stand up and hold a team jersey with their name on it at the press conference announcing their new deal. He signed a washed-up Bruce Smith and a washed-up Deion Sanders. After a rare successful season in 1999 with Brad Johnson at quarterback, Snyder signed Jeff George, famous for 2 things, a cannon arm and being a cancer in every locker room he ever walked into. Johnson went on to lead the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to a Super Bowl victory after the 2002 season. Washington was George's 5th team. He played in 6 games in 2000 before being cut 2 games into the 2001 season by coach Marty Schottenheimer. He signed 3 different times with NFL teams over the next 5 years, but never again appeared in an NFL game. Late in 2009, Snyder hired Bruce Allen, the son of George Allen, to be team president, and more than anything, to take the brickbats being hurled at Snyder. Allen became the public face of the franchise's decision-making, and many people forgot that it was Snyder who was really calling the shots. Snyder and Allen had reached a new low early in 2017 when, after firing Scott McLuhan as general manager, they leaked allegations to the Washington Post that McLuhan, a recovering alcoholic, had started drinking again months earlier, and that was what had led to his firing. Whether the rumors were true or not, the actions of the 2 men in the wake of the firing were about as despicable as anything they'd ever done, and the anger at the duo was as loud as it had ever been. It didn't get better as the Kirk Cousins contract situation began to heat up, as Allen repeatedly referred to Kirk Cousins as Kurt when discussing the team's failed negotiations with the quarterback. Once again, the team had to put the franchise tag on him, this time for $23.9 million for 2017. Cousins became the first quarterback ever franchised 2 years in a row. The tag meant Washington would pay him $43.7 million for 2016 and 2017, as opposed to the $45 million guaranteed that would have locked him up for 5 years if Snyder and Allen had followed McLuhan's recommendation. Donald Trump's presidency was only mildly controversial compared to the screaming and yelling going on in the media and on sports talk radio about Cousins. Most fans supported the player. His numbers for 2 years had been outstanding. He completed 68.3% of his passes, and the team had gone from 4-12 in 2014 to 9-7 in 2015 and a division title, and 8-7-1 in 2016. Both team and player maintained that there was still hope that a long-term deal could be agreed on after the 2017 season. There was no truth to that. For all his boy-next-door sweetness in public, Cousins felt dissed by Snyder and Allen, a feeling that only grew stronger during the strange Kurt period. The team knew he wasn't coming back. There were Cousins critics who pointed out that he had a tendency to throw interceptions at critical moments and had failed miserably in the season finale in 2016 against a Giants team that had already clinched a playoff spot. That loss had kept Washington from making the playoffs in back-to-back seasons for the first time since 1992. When they had made the postseason for a 3rd straight time in the final season of Joe Gibbs' first tenure as coach. The opening day loss made the critics' voices louder. The interception on a poorly thrown pass into the end zone early in the fourth quarter brought back memories of other key failures. Then the team turned around and won against the Rams in Los Angeles, which in retrospect might have been their best win of the season, and followed that up with a stunning 27-10 victory at home in a Sunday night game against the Oakland Raiders. The Raiders were going through their own ups and downs. They had finished 12-4 in 2016, their first winning record since 2002. But their season had been derailed in the penultimate game of the regular season when their quarterback, Derek Carr, broke his leg with the team leading the Colts 33-14. The injury to Carr and what happened to the Raiders in the aftermath, a complete meltdown the rest of 2016, were emblematic of what often happens when a star quarterback, or for that matter, a good quarterback, goes down. The second Carr hit the ground and began grabbing at his leg, the Raiders' season was over. He was healthy again to start 2017, and had signed a 5-year, $125 million contract extension in June, making him, for the moment, the highest-paid player in the NFL. That was why the Raiders were being mentioned as a serious Super Bowl contender. They had opened the season with easy victories over the Titans and the Jets. The game in Washington, Maryland actually, was the last of a long NFL Sunday that had begun in London with the Titans-Ravens game, and it continued through an afternoon of protests, linked arms, kneeling, and teams staying in the locker room. Snyder and Doug Williams were both on the field for the anthem, although neither one knelt before it was played. About a half dozen Washington players, most notable among them starting tight end Jordan Reed, knelt during the anthem. Just prior to the kickoff, the team put out a non-statement statement, calling football the great unifier in the U.S., and paying tribute to those who served in the military. Unlike other statements that had been signed by owners, this one was unsigned. That was hardly a surprise, since Snyder, according to the Federal Election Commission, had given $1 million to Donald Trump's inaugural fund. He was one of seven NFL owners listed as giving at least that much to Trump, among them Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, who did briefly take a knee with his players the next night in Arizona prior to the playing of the anthem. Raiders owner Mark Davis, who was and is in the process of abandoning Oakland to move his team to Las Vegas, did not come down on the field for the Sunday night kickoff. He did, however, say in an ESPN interview that under the circumstances, he didn't feel he could ask or order his players not to protest in some way. Most of them sat, arms linked, on their bench during the playing of the anthem. Then they went out and got clocked by the home team. Cousins may have had his best game ever that night. He completed 25 of 30 passes for 365 yards and 3 touchdowns. The game was never really in serious doubt, and the final was 27-10. As it turned out, that loss was the beginning of the end for the Raiders. A week later, their downward spiral continued when Carr was hurt again, this time a back injury, in a loss in Denver, and the season never got back on track again after that. Meanwhile, as people all over town scrambled for seats on the 2-1 Sign Kirk Now bandwagon, Washington headed to Kansas City for a Monday night game with the undefeated Chiefs. There would be more scrambling, much more, on and off the bandwagon before the season was over. 17. Alex Smith was surprised to see how easily Washington had handled Oakland in the Sunday night game at the end of Week 3. The Chiefs had traveled to Los Angeles that day and beaten the winless Chargers 24-10 to raise their record to 3-0. There were only two undefeated teams left in the league after just 3 weeks, the Chiefs and the Falcons. Smith had thought it very possible the Raiders would also be unbeaten. They just got outplayed the entire night, Smith said after watching Washington's dominant win. Kirk was terrific, and their defense did a great job on Derek Carr. I figured we would have our hands full on Monday night. Washington would be coming to Arrowhead the following Monday for the Chiefs' second home game of the season. As Smith had feared, Cousins and his offense picked up right where they had left off the previous Sunday, taking the opening kickoff and driving 75 yards to open the scoring with a touchdown. A few minutes later, it was 10-0, and Smith and his offense were struggling. The Chiefs slowly began to get their offense moving in the second quarter. Finally, with halftime approaching, they put together their first sustained drive of the night, driving 73 yards and ending with a Smith to Travis Kelce 17-yard touchdown pass that closed the margin to 10-7. It should have been tied at halftime, but Harrison Butker missed a field goal attempt for the Chiefs from 46 yards in the final seconds, and Washington retained the lead. But Smith was rolling now. Coming out of halftime, the Chiefs put together a 10-play, 79-yard drive, with Smith scoring from the one to take their first lead of the night, 14-10. Washington's offense, which had been dormant since the first quarter, got that surge of urgency that so often comes from falling behind, and answered right away, Cousins hitting Ryan Grant for the touchdown that made it 17-14. Then it became a battle of field goals, both defenses bending without breaking. When Washington's Dustin Hopkins hit from 40 yards to tie the game 20-20 with 47 seconds left, it looked like overtime was inevitable. But in the hands of an experienced NFL quarterback, 47 seconds can be forever. Starting at his own 25, Smith threw a quick out for 4 yards to Charkhandrick West, who stepped out of bounds with 42 seconds left. Then Smith made a play with both his arm and his legs. He dropped back knowing he needed to pick up a chunk of yardage, and, finding no one open, scrambled to his right to avoid the rush. As he approached the line of scrimmage, he made a leaping throw down the sideline to Albert Wilson, who had come open as Smith kept the play alive. Wilson picked up 37 yards before being brought down. Smith used one of his two timeouts to stop the clock with 33 seconds still to go. The ball was on the Washington 34, which was within Butker's range, although the miss from 46 in the first half gave Smith some pause. Harrison's a really good kicker, Smith said. He's got plenty of leg to make a field goal from that distance, but we had some time and a timeout, so why not try to give him some breathing room? He did that, this time finding Chris Conley, again over the middle. The pickup was 10 to the 24. Smith used the last timeout with 27 seconds left. At that point, he felt comfortable that the kick would be well within Butker's range. There was no need to put the ball in the air and take any risk, so he simply handed it to Hunt, who ran to the middle of the field to make the kick straight away. Smith spiked the ball with 8 seconds left. Butker came in and calmly drilled a kick from 43 yards for a 23-20 lead with only 4 seconds remaining. Washington had one last desperation chance. Butker kicked off into the end zone, and there was time for one final snap. Cousins threw a quick out pass to Jamison Crowder, who tried to throw it back to him to set up a trick play. The ball ended up on the ground, and Justin Houston finally picked it up and ran into the end zone, creating a deceiving final score of 29-20. Of course, gambling being as huge as it is in the NFL, many, most, were aware of how the last second touchdown affected betting outcomes. The spread on the game had been 7 points, Chiefs favored. The over-under was 48.5. That meant those who had bet Washington with the points went from winners to losers, and those who had bet the under also went from a win to a loss on a meaningless final play. Prior to the Supreme Court ruling allowing gambling on sports in all 50 states, the NFL strictly forbade its TV partners from talking about betting lines on air. Given that much of the NFL's appeal is because of people betting hundreds of millions of dollars on the league each year, a number that will skyrocket in light of the Supreme Court ruling, it is laughable the way the league liked to wring its hands as if it disapproved of betting. While claiming on the one hand that betting on football is a bad thing, the league clamped down on teams that failed to submit honest injury reports each week or in-game, knowing full well that hiding injuries affects betting lines. Teams are often required to submit practice tape to the league. If a player not listed as injured doesn't play, or if someone listed as doubtful or out, miraculously makes it to the field on Sunday. This is done in part because opponents will complain when such things happen, but also because the NFL knows if those who take bets can't rely on honest injury reports, they might have to give money back to bettors, which won't make them happy. After Houston's touchdown, ESPN's Sean McDonough settled for, "This might be meaningful to some." The win was certainly meaningful to the Chiefs, who, with the victory, were the NFL's last remaining unbeaten team. The Falcons had lost on Sunday at home to the Bills. Smith was already getting early mention for MVP, understandably, given his play. The Chiefs had become a media darling team, not just because they were unbeaten, but because they were entertaining and had a locker room full of good talkers, notably Smith, tight end Travis Kelce, and Justin Houston. Ask Kelce what day of the week it is, and he'll give you 20 good minutes, Smith liked to say, of his voluble and talented tight end. Like most starting quarterbacks, Joe Flacco being a notable exception, Smith was always the last player to speak to the media post-game. He would talk briefly at his locker with the Chiefs' superb public relations man, Ted Cruz, just to make sure there wasn't something Cruz didn't know about, a possible injury, a play that had bothered Smith, something he didn't want to talk about. "Never happens," Cruz said of the last possibility. "Alex is an absolute pro." While the other players went through their media paces in front of their lockers, Smith would get out of his uniform, shower, and dress, usually wearing a sharp suit, often black, occasionally pinstriped with a white shirt and a matching tie and pocket square. Waiting for the quarterback in the interview room can be like waiting for Godot for the media, especially if they are deadline-pressed. Like Flacco and most others, Smith knows it doesn't do any good to throw anyone under the bus. He can be self-critical and might express occasional frustration with an officiating call, but that's as far as it usually goes. By the time he's finished, the locker room is almost always empty, and on the road, the bus is waiting. He will grab a snack put out by the staff outside the locker room and jump on the bus. In Kansas City, he meets his family for the short drive home. His mood is dictated by the outcome. That usually doesn't change until the next day, when it's time to move on to the next opponent. "I sleep like a baby 6 nights a week," he said. "Sunday night, any game night, is different. I don't sleep much at all, win or lose. Some of it is just the adrenaline of the day. It's hard to slow it down. It's still there. When I get home, once the three kids are down, Elizabeth and I will usually stay up for a while talking the day through. Mostly she listens, although there are times when she gets frustrated by things too. I know it's often harder to watch than play, so I get it. We sort of try to talk until we're too tired to talk. Then I go to bed and lie there and replay every play that could have gone better. Obviously, I do it a lot more after a loss than a win because I know there's almost always something I could have done to change the outcome. Either way, it's part of the process for me to let go of the game and be ready Monday to walk into the quarterback room with the game behind me and the next one in front of me." For the first 5 weeks of the season, Smith slept about as well as he possibly could on game nights. The Chiefs went to Houston in Week 5 and won 42-34 in an old-fashioned Texas shootout, with both Smith and Deshaun Watson shining. Smith was 29 of 37 and threw 3 touchdown passes. Watson was 16 of 31 for 261 yards and 5 touchdowns. That game proved to be the beginning of the end for the Texans. J.J. Watt broke his leg and was done for the season. The Texans remained competitive thanks to their offense until Watson tore his ACL in practice in early November. The Chiefs were 5-0 after the win over the Texans and flying high. They hadn't lost since the painful playoff defeat in January to the Steelers at Arrowhead. Next on the schedule, the Steelers at Arrowhead. The direction of the NFL's 2017 season began to take shape for real in Week 5. The winless Chargers went to the Meadowlands and beat the winless Giants. The game began a turnaround for the team formerly from San Diego that would lead them, shockingly, into contention in the AFC West in December. The loss kept the Giants spiraling in a direction that would lead to some of the low moments in franchise history. The Eagles easily beat the Arizona Cardinals to be 4-1. In a game that would prove to be a harbinger, the Jaguars walked into Pittsburgh and routed the Steelers 39. The loss left Ben Roethlisberger questioning his ability to be effective in his 14th NFL season and began to make people believe that the Jaguars might be for real. The Ravens had to travel to the West Coast, meaning they would travel a little more than 12,000 miles in just over 2 weeks, playing in London and then, after a week at home, in Oakland. Even so, they bounced back from their embarrassing loss to the Steelers with a 30-17 victory in Oakland. It certainly didn't hurt that Derek Carr had to sit out the game, and the Raiders were quarterbacked by E.J. Manuel. He was a considerable upgrade from Carr's replacements the previous January, but still several levels below Carr. The first offensive play of the game for the Ravens was the same deep pass down the sideline from Joe Flacco to Mike Wallace that Wallace had dropped against the Steelers. This time, the ball floated perfectly into Wallace's hands, and he caught it in stride for a 52-yard gain to the Oakland 23. Four plays later, running back Vince Male scored from the 2-yard line, and the Ravens had scored as many touchdowns in 2:15 in Oakland as they had scored in 60 minutes a week earlier in Baltimore. On the Raiders' opening series, tight end Jared Cook caught a short pass from Manuel and fumbled. Baltimore's Jimmy Smith picked the ball up at the Raiders' 47 and raced into the end zone, making it 14-0. The Ravens never really looked back. When the Raiders managed to creep within 24-17 late in the third quarter, Flacco took the offense on two long clock-killing drives that led to Justin Tucker field goals. The final was 30-17, and with the Steelers' loss, the Ravens were again tied for first place in the AFC North at 3-2. Suddenly, all was well in Mudville. The game of the day, though, as everyone expected, was in Dallas. The Packers had destroyed the Cowboys' dream season the previous January with an Aaron Rodgers miracle in the NFC Divisional playoff round. The Cowboys had gone 13-3 after rookie Dak Prescott, a fourth-round pick out of Mississippi State, had taken over at quarterback when Tony Romo again went down, this time with a back injury during preseason. The Cowboys had gotten lucky. With the 135th pick in the 2016 draft and their second pick of the fourth round, they took Prescott. Prescott was a perfect example of how flawed NFL scouting can be, especially at the quarterback position. He wasn't that tall, 6'2", and his arm wasn't a cannon. He was labeled an athlete by scouts, which is often code for he's black. All that added up to Prescott being just the eighth quarterback chosen in the draft. The Cowboys had released Brandon Weeden when Romo returned, and they let Matt Castle leave to sign with Tennessee. That left Prescott to compete with Matt Moore to be Romo's backup. When Prescott played superbly in exhibition games, the general thinking was that he might be ready to replace Romo in a year or two. It didn't take that long. Romo got hurt at the end of preseason, and Prescott became the starter. The Cowboys lost their opener at home to the Giants 2019. They then won 11 in a row. They entered the playoffs with a 13-3 record and the number one seed in the NFC. The Packers had beaten the Giants easily in the wild card round and came to Dallas to play a team that hadn't been to the Super Bowl since the 1995 season. The game was a back-and-forth duel between an old master, Rodgers had turned 33 in December, and a young one, Prescott was 23. It came down to a battle of two-minute offenses and two of the best field goal kickers in the game. Rodgers drove the Packers to the Cowboys 38, but the drive stalled, and Mason Crosby came in to nail a 56-yard field goal with 1:33 to go. That was plenty of time for the rookie Prescott. His drive bogged down on the Green Bay 33, and Dan Bailey tied the game again with a 51-yarder. Remarkably, the Cowboys had left too much time, 35 seconds, on the clock for Rodgers. After a sack and an incompletion left the Packers with 3rd and 20 at their own 32, overtime appeared to be a certainty. It would have been, with almost any quarterback on the field other than Rodgers. Rodgers took the snap with 12 seconds left. Pressured, he rolled left and made a throw that perhaps no one else in the game, including Tom Brady, who couldn't possibly escape the rush the way Rodgers did, could make. He put the ball right on the outstretched hands of Jared Cook, the same Jared Cook who would hand the Ravens a touchdown in Oakland on that October afternoon in Week 5 of the 2017 season, who somehow got both feet down before falling out of bounds. The play had to be reviewed for several minutes before officials in New York confirmed Cook had made the catch at the Dallas 32, a gain of 36 yards. With 3 seconds left, Crosby came on and was perfect again, this time from 50 yards. Game over. Season over for the Cowboys. Shocked fans exited the stadium, headed to another long off season. Now, 9 months later, the Packers returned to Dallas. Rodgers was playing at an MVP level, and the Packers were 3-1. The Cowboys were a surprising 2-2, having been routed in Denver in Week 2, and then losing at home the week before to the resurgent Rams. With the Eagles already 4-1, the game was surprisingly important to Dallas. The game was different from the playoff game, but the result was the same. Prescott gave the Cowboys a late 31-28 lead, with an 11-yard scramble that came at the end of a remarkable 17-play, 79-yard drive that took 8:43 off the clock. That, however, was not enough, because Rodgers still had 1:13 and a timeout left to work with. For Rodgers, that's almost like working out of an easy chair. The Packers quickly drove into Crosby's range for a tying field goal. Rodgers was having none of it. On 3rd and 8, he again made a play very few quarterbacks could make, scrambling left, pulling the ball down, and racing to the Cowboys' 12 before stepping out of bounds. First down. Still 21 seconds on the clock. Rodgers threw incomplete to Davante Adams. 16 seconds left. Rodgers went back to Adams, throwing a perfect pass on a straight fly route to the corner that Adams leaped for and caught with 11 seconds left. As Yogi Berra might say, it was deja vu all over again. The Packers won 35-31, and most Cowboy fans went home cursing the name Aaron Rodgers. Dallas was 2-3, and as it turned out, would never challenge the Eagles in the NFC East. Green Bay was 4-1, seemingly poised to run away with the NFC North. But the NFL is often like the weather in San Francisco. If you don't like it now, be patient. Things will almost certainly change in the near future. There were a surprising number of empty seats at kickoff in Baltimore on October 15th, even after the Ravens' win the previous week in Oakland. It was something Joe Flacco and his teammates couldn't help but notice. The Ravens were hosting the Bears on a warm and humid day approaching 70 degrees. "We just won in Oakland, and even though we played lousy against the Steelers, we were tied for first place," he said. It, the empty seats, was something I think we all couldn't help but notice as the season went along, because we weren't used to it. For the most part, Baltimore loved its football team. The Ravens had arrived in 1996, after the city had been without an NFL team for 12 years, the Colts stolen from the city by owner Robert Irsay, who packed up and left town for Indianapolis in the middle of the night in the spring of 1984. There were some people who didn't feel right about Baltimore getting a team stolen from another city, Cleveland, but that passed quickly, especially after the NFL awarded an expansion franchise to Cleveland soon after the Browns had become the Ravens. The Ravens played in Memorial Stadium, the former home of the Colts and the Orioles, for 2 seasons, while the new stadium the city had committed to building for them was completed. Then, in their 3rd season in the new place, which has had various corporate names on it since opening in 1998, they won the Super Bowl. They had been a solid competitive franchise for most of the 21st century and had won a 2nd Super Bowl in February 2013. Tickets to what was now M&T Bank Stadium became very tough to find. There are 2 statues outside the stadium, one of Johnny Unitas, the great Colts quarterback, and one of Ray Lewis, the iconic linebacker generally considered the greatest Raven of them all. Flacco is without question the Ravens' greatest quarterback. Unlike many franchises that move, the Ravens were forced to leave all the Browns' records and history behind. When the Indianapolis Colts talk about their greatest players in history, both Johnny Unitas and Peyton Manning are part of it, as is the Baltimore Colts' Super Bowl V victory over the Cowboys. But Jim Brown and Otto Graham aren't mentioned in the Ravens' record books. Their legacies remain in Cleveland with the expansion, 1999, Browns. The Ravens' victory in Oakland had been a relief, not just because it stopped the 2-game losing streak, 3 straight losses in the NFL, is roughly the equivalent of a 30-game losing streak in baseball, but because the offense showed some life. Flacco threw the ball well, the receivers caught the ball well, and the running game was effective. Still, Flacco knew there was no reason to get comfortable. The Bears were not a good team, but that didn't mean there wasn't reason to worry, even playing at home. The Bears were 1-3 when coach John Fox decided he had seen enough of quarterback Mike Glennon, the $45 million offseason acquisition. Mitchell Trubisky, the much-ballyhooed number 2 pick in the draft, had gotten the start in Minnesota on the previous Monday night in Week 5 and had played reasonably well, driving the Bears to a late tying touchdown. The Vikings started Sam Bradford that night, thinking his knee had healed enough for him to play. He could play, just not effectively. He looked like a statue in the pocket and could barely move at all. That led to a sack for a safety late in the first half, which meant the halftime score was 3-2. Given the score, Vikings coach Mike Zimmer went to the bullpen to start the second half, bringing Case Keenum in for Bradford. Keenum got the offense going, leading two touchdown drives. The Bears tied the game at 17 early in the fourth quarter, but the game turned on Trubisky's one truly bad mistake of the night, a pass he intended for tight end Zach Miller that was intercepted by safety Harrison Smith at the Bears 26 with 2:32 left. Keenum kept the ball on the ground and ran the clock down to 12 seconds before Kai Forbath came in and kicked the winning field goal from 26 yards. That meant the Bears came into Baltimore still planning to keep the game plan fairly simple, with Trubisky getting his second start. The thing you need to do in a game like that, especially at home, is not give the other guys hope, Flacco said. Let them know you're the better team right away. The Ravens did exactly the opposite. The offense sputtered the entire first quarter, picking up one first down in three series. The Bears weren't much better, and the score was 0-0 after one. It got worse in the second quarter. The Bears managed a drive that led to a field goal, the key play being a 12-yard run by Trubisky, and took a 3-0 lead. The Ravens quickly moved the ball to the Chicago 26. On third and six, Flacco completed a short pass to tight end Max Williams, one of several players trying to fill the large shoes vacated by Dennis Pitta. Williams made the catch and appeared to have a first down when he was hit by linebacker Christian Jones and fumbled. Danny Trevathan fell on it at the Bears 20, and the boos started again. They got louder a few minutes later, when Flacco, trying to throw deep to Breshad Perriman, was intercepted. Perriman was open at the Bears 35, but the ball hit him in the worst possible spot, his hands. He bobbled it, then was hit hard by Kyle Fuller as the ball bounced into the air and into the hands of diving safety Ryan Callahan. For a split second, no one but Callahan realized he had scooped the ball up before it hit the ground. He scrambled to his feet untouched and took the ball back to the Ravens 20. Most game stories describe Perriman as bobbling the ball because of Fuller's hit, but replays showed that Perriman was bobbling the ball even before being hit. Even so, the interception was charged to Flacco, and the boos rained down. As always, the quarterback takes the best and the worst. The Bears scored two plays later on a trick play, Trubisky flipping the ball to running back Tariq Cohen, who ran right, pulled up, and found Zach Miller open in the end zone. That made the score 10-0 with 3:36 to go. Flacco was able to get the Ravens into position for a 27-yard Justin Tucker field goal to make it 10-3 at the half, but the Ravens had already committed the cardinal sin of giving a bad team hope. Things didn't get any better at the start of the third quarter. The Ravens went 3-and-out on their first series, and the Bears proceeded to drive 67 yards to extend the lead to a stunning 17-3. And yet, just when fans were thinking about heading for the exits, come late, leave early, the game turned on one play. The Bears did what bad teams do. With one mistake, they led a team back into the game when it was down. It happened on the kickoff, after the Bears' touchdown, when Bobby Rainey returned the kick 96 yards for a touchdown, appearing to be down at one point, but continuing on because no one on the Bears ever touched him. Suddenly, it was 17-10, and people went back to their seats. It looked like the Ravens had tied the game early in the fourth quarter, when, with the ball on the Bears' 10, Flacco scrambled and found Mike Wallace in the end zone for a touchdown. But this was a Murphy's Law day for the Ravens. Flacco, hardly known for his ability to scramble, had crossed the line of scrimmage just before throwing the pass to Wallace. Instead of a tying touchdown, the Ravens had to settle for another Tucker field goal, making it 17-13. Murphy showed up again a few minutes later. With the Ravens driving, Flacco rolled right on third and four from the Bears 33 and found Chris Moore down the right sideline. But Moore was hit as he tried to catch the ball, and, naturally, it bounced off his hands into the air and was intercepted 10 yards farther downfield by third-year cornerback Adrian Amos, who had never had an NFL interception. Amos weaved his way 90 yards for a touchdown to make it 24-13, and it seemed the Ravens had been put out of their misery. But remember that thing about bad teams? Tucker kicked another field goal with 3:01 left to make it 24-16. Then, with the Bears trying to run out the clock on the ground, Jordan Howard, who was having a career day, was stopped for a 2-yard loss on 3rd-and-1 at the Chicago 26, forcing a punt with 1:55 left after the Ravens spent their last time out. The Ravens still had a chance, but they would have to go the length of the field with no timeouts to score a touchdown, which the offense hadn't done all day, and then make a 2-point conversion to tie. Long odds, or so it seemed. Then Michael Campanaro, who returned punts largely because he had good hands and was unlikely to fumble, fielded the punt at his own 23. Somehow he got outside the Bears defenders and went untouched 77 yards down the sideline to score. Much of the crowd was gone by then, having departed after the Amos interception. Those who were left went nuts as Flacco and the offense came on to go for two. Flacco found Nick Boyle, another Pitta wannabe, for the 2-point score, and remarkably, the game was tied. Even Cool Joe shook his fist at that development. "The game looked lost after the interception," he said later. "Then all of a sudden, we've got a real chance to win, to really steal a win. They gave us a chance. At that moment, I thought we were going to get it done." Any thought of the Bears trying to get into field goal range with 1:37 left went away when Trubisky fumbled a shotgun snap and had to retreat to the 19 to recover. Overtime. The NFL had shortened overtime at the start of the season from 15 minutes to 10 minutes, largely to reduce wear and tear on teams forced to play an extra quarter, at least a little bit. The Ravens had all the momentum, and when the Bears were forced to punt and punter Pat O'Donnell semi-shanked the punt so it went out of bounds on the Ravens' 40, all Flacco and his offense had to do was move the ball 20 yards, maximum, to be within Tucker's range. But they couldn't do it, going 3-and-out, when Flacco's 3rd-and-2 pass to Moore was knocked down. Punter Sam Cook pinned the Bears at their 7. If the Ravens could get the Bears off the field in a 3-and-out, they might get the ball back already in field goal range. The Bears had run the ball well all day, and pinned deep, it seemed unlikely they'd try anything fancy. They didn't. On first down, Howard, who would finish the day with 164 yards, ran left and appeared surrounded. One tackler missed, then two, then three. He kept spinning free. By the time he was done, he'd pulled free and gone 53 yards to the Ravens' 40. Just like that, the stadium deflated again, as did the Ravens' sideline. With room to work, the Bears allowed Trubisky to throw. On a 3rd-and-11, still not quite in field goal range for kicker Connor Barth, Trubisky found Kendall Wright open down the seam for 18 yards to the Ravens' 23. That, finally, was the dagger. The Bears ran 3 up the middle running plays, why they waited for 3 plays no one quite knew, and brought Barth in for a 40-yard attempt with 2:11 to go. The kick was down the middle, and mercifully for those watching, the game was over. Bears 27, Ravens 24. John Harbaugh went into the interview room before Flacco, even though Flacco very much wanted to do his thing and get the heck out of the building. Harbaugh didn't really have much to say. Asked about the Bears' 254 yards rushing, he shrugged and said, "I can't answer that," what the problem was. "I just saw them running for a lot of yards." He insisted his players had played their hearts out, which is straight out of the coach's handbook for not calling your team out in public. NFL teams are asked to show up 16 times a year. Anyone who doesn't play his heart out shouldn't be playing. Flacco was asked if losing this way to a bad team was especially tough to take. "When it looks like you're out of a game and then you have a chance to win," he paused. He could see the headlines. "Flacco calls loss devastating," or "Flacco says Ravens never should have lost." He regrouped, shrugged, and said, "Every loss stings. They all sting." This was more than a stinger. Very few teams in the NFL have any margin for error because the season is so short. A bad loss can knock you out of home field advantage, out of a bye, or, worst of all, out of the playoffs. The Ravens were now 3-3, rather than a rosier 4-2, and this loss wouldn't go away anytime soon. To be successful, unless you're the Patriots, you probably have to win 2 games in a season you don't deserve to win, Flacco said later. That was one of those games. We had too many turnovers and didn't move the ball nearly enough. He paused and shook his head. We, the offense, didn't score a touchdown. That's on me. Both interceptions he had thrown had been good throws that went off his receiver's hands and into the hands of Bears defenders. Didn't matter. It's always on the quarterback in the NFL. 18. On the same afternoon that the Ravens were losing a game that their quarterback claimed was on him, the Green Bay Packers were losing something far more important, their quarterback. The Packers arrived in Minneapolis to play the Vikings in two-year-old U.S. Bank Stadium on a roll. They were 4-1 coming off their stunning win in Dallas. The Vikings were 3-2, and their quarterback was again Case Keenum, since Bradford was out again with his recurring knee problems. U.S. Bank Stadium would be the site of the Super Bowl in February. Many believed this would be a good chance for the Packers to get a feel for the place. On the Packers' second possession, they faced a 2nd-and-9 at their own 39. Out of the shotgun, Rodgers dropped, looked left, and found no one open. He rolled right, found some space, and spotted Martellus Bennett wide open 10 yards downfield. His pass hit Bennett in the hands, and he dropped it. That wasn't the important part of the play. As Rodgers scrambled, outside linebacker Anthony Barr had a clear path to him and ran straight at him. Barr hit Rodgers a split second after he released the ball. There was no penalty, and later when the league looked at the hit, Barr wasn't fined. It was one of those bang-bang football plays in which it would have been virtually impossible for Barr to pull up. He hit Rodgers on his left side, but as Rodgers went down, he tried to cushion his fall with his right hand. The minute he hit the ground and rolled over, clearly in pain, it was apparent he was hurt, or more accurately, injured. Quarterbacks are hurt every time they take a hit. Most of the time they get up, shake it off, and walk back to the huddle. Not this time. Rodgers rolled onto his back and lay there as the Packers' medical staff rushed out to see if he was okay. As he watched from the far sideline, Case Keenum's football and quarterback instincts told him that he wasn't okay. You could see by the way he was holding his arm as he came off that it didn't look good, he said. It was very upsetting. We all know it's a violent game and people get hurt. All of us get hurt at some point. But as a quarterback, I could almost literally feel his pain. And as someone who loves football, I know that the game, the sport, is a lot better when Aaron Rodgers is playing. He makes it better. As Keenum described, Rodgers was holding his right arm at his side as he came off. He was taken off on a cart, and the report came back pretty quickly after an in-stadium x-ray. His collarbone was broken. At best, he might return for the final few weeks of the season. At that moment, the axis of the NFL changed. The Packers went from being a Super Bowl favorite to just another team. Brett Hundley, who had been drafted in the 5th round coming out of UCLA in 2015, came into the game to replace Rodgers. Hundley hadn't played a down in 2015, and in 2016 had thrown 10 passes, completing 2 of them. Under the absolute best of circumstances, trying to replace Aaron Rodgers would be almost impossible for anybody. These weren't close to the best of circumstances. Hundley came into a 0-0 game on the road against one of the league's best defenses. What happened was predictable. On Hundley's first full series, he simply handed off on 3rd-and-9 after the Bennett drop and the Packers punted. He was intercepted by safety Xavier Rhodes at the Packers' 27-yard line. 2 plays later, Keenum found running back Jerick McKinnon, and he raced into the end zone for a 7-0 lead. The Packers did manage to tie the game 7-7 after Clay Matthews returned a McKinnon fumble 63 yards to the Minnesota 18. Hundley threw a 14-yard pass to Devontae Adams, who had caught the winning touchdown pass from Rodgers a week earlier, to tie the score. That, though, was Green Bay's last real hurrah. The Packers scored 3 points the rest of the afternoon, while Keenum patiently directed a long drive to make it 14-7, and then the Vikings happily settled for 3 four-bath field goals in the second half. The Packers' second half possessions went like this. Punt, interception, punt, stopped on downs, interception. They never came close to scoring. With Rodgers playing, there was no way that would happen. The reality, though, was that Rodgers wouldn't be playing for a long time. By the time Barr, who had hit Rodgers, turned on his phone after the game, he had more than 3,000 tweets. Most of them not very nice, he said later, from people telling him what they thought of his hit. He was called a Minnesota terrorist, among other things, that shouldn't be repeated. The vitriol continued to pour in long after the game was over. "I'm truly sorry it happened," Barr said later that week. "I don't want to see anybody hurt, and certainly not Aaron Rodgers. He's one of the best players in the game. It wasn't a dirty hit. Clearly, I didn't mean to hurt him." Rarely do players mean to hurt another player. Sometimes they commit dirty plays because they get overamped in the heat of the game or because they think it's the best way to make a play. That's one reason why targeting has become a major penalty, although the NFL still hasn't gotten around to making ejection mandatory when a player is whistled for targeting. The Packers' season was ruined after the injury. Hundley simply didn't have the experience to step in and play well enough for the team to compete, much less be a Super Bowl contender. The Vikings' victory that week made them 4-2, and for the moment, left them tied with the Packers at the top of the division. There were still plenty of questions about how good the Vikings were. The defense was excellent, but the question was, could a team actually compete at the top levels of the league with Case Keenum as the starting quarterback? Unlike Hundley, Keenum did have experience. He had been in the NFL for 6 years and had played in Houston, St. Louis, Houston again, St. Louis a second time, and Los Angeles when the Rams moved there from St. Louis after the 2015 season. His was an intriguing story. He had spent 6 seasons at the University of Houston, redshirting as a freshman, then tearing his ACL in the third game of his redshirt senior season. The NCAA had granted him a 6th season of eligibility. He was a graduate student by then, and he'd had a remarkable season. The Cougars finished 13-1. They had gone into the Conference USA title game 12-0 with dreams of perhaps getting a New Year's Day bowl bid. But they were upset by Southern Mississippi and ended up in the less-than-glamorous Ticket City Bowl game in Dallas. Their opponent was Penn State, which had fallen off its pedestal 2 months earlier in the wake of the Jerry Sandusky scandal that had led to the firing of legendary coach Joe Paterno. The Nittany Lions had been 8-1 when the Sandusky scandal became public. They'd beaten Illinois on October 29th for Paterno's 409th win, which allowed him to break Eddie Robinson's all-time record for victories. No one knew that day that the game would not only be Paterno's last win, but the last time he coached a football game. A week later, with Penn State off, Sandusky was arrested and charged with multiple counts of child rape. 4 days after that, Paterno was fired. In the midst of the scandal, the Nittany Lions lost to Nebraska, then beat a bad 6-6 Ohio State team before being crushed in the regular season finale by Wisconsin. By the time they got to Dallas, most of the players just wanted the season to be over. Keenum and the Cougars took full advantage, winning 30-14, with Keenum throwing for 532 yards. He finished the season with an astonishing 5,246 yards passing. In other words, he averaged more than 400 yards a game. And yet, when the NFL draft came, Keenum sat and watched 7 rounds go by without hearing his name called. He was a classic example of a player overlooked because of his size. At the combine, he had measured 6'5". His arm strength was considered average. Speed, 4.8 in the 40, slightly above average. But, as is always pointed out, when the quarterbacks who should, according to the scouts, succeed, don't, and quarterbacks who shouldn't succeed do, you can't measure heart. Drew Brees and Russell Wilson, both of whom have won Super Bowls, are shorter than Keenum. Aaron Rodgers, also a Super Bowl winner, is about 1 inch taller. But scouts are conditioned to fall back on things like hand size and arm strength. Prior to the 2018 draft, when various quarterbacks were being bandied about as a potential number one pick, scouts kept bringing up the fact that Wyoming quarterback Josh Allen had huge hands, which was one big reason why he might go number one. Big hands might help, and so might arm strength, but they are rarely the reason why a quarterback succeeds. Tom Brady dropped to the 6th round because he was much too slow, 5'2", 8'40", to survive in an NFL pocket. His arm strength was solid, but not great. If you ask those who have coached him, they will tell you what was missed by the scouts were 2 things. Ability to communicate to your teammates exactly what you want done, and decision-making, both at the line of scrimmage and in the pocket. Brady may be the best decision-maker of all time. If he audibles, it is almost always to the right play. He's almost never intercepted because he knows when to take a sack. More often than not, when Brady does throw an interception, it's because he's hit as he's throwing or because the ball is tipped or deflected in some way. In 2016, he threw 28 touchdown passes and was intercepted twice. In 2017, he wasn't quite as good, throwing 32 touchdown passes while being intercepted 7 times. In 37 postseason games, facing good teams with good defenses in almost every game, Brady has thrown 71 touchdown passes and 31 interceptions. The Patriots are 27-10 in those games, including 8 trips to the Super Bowl and 5 Super Bowl titles. Communication and decision-making. Hand size and arm strength don't accomplish either one of those things. Keenum ended up in Houston as a practice squad player in 2012. The next year, injuries pushed him into a starting role, but the team went 0-8 in the games he started. He was waived at the end of training camp the following year so that the Texans could bring in Ryan Mallett, and Keenum was signed by the Rams, cut by the Rams, and re-signed by the Texans. Late in the season, after Ryan Fitzpatrick broke his leg, Keenum got 2 starts, and the Texans won both games. Then he was traded back to the Rams for a 7th-round draft pick. He began 2015 as the Rams' backup to Nick Foles. When Foles played poorly, he was benched, and Keenum became the starter. Playing against the Ravens, Keenum was clearly knocked silly in the second quarter. He was examined by the team's doctors and returned to the game. If he went through the NFL-mandated concussion protocol, he did it in record time. The NFL investigated, but of course, nothing came of it. The Rams moved back to L.A. in 2016 and were that year's Hard Knocks team. Naturally, much of the focus was on the quarterbacks. Keenum, named the starter by coach Jeff Fisher before camp started, and Jared Goff, the number one pick in the draft. Keenum and his wife Kimberly became stars of the 4 shows because they were outgoing and smart, and because the notion of someone who had been an undrafted free agent coming out of college and had bounced around competing with the number one pick in the draft was intriguing. Keenum started the first 9 games. The Rams were 3-1 before the roof caved in on them. Keenum's low point came in a game in London against the Giants, in which he threw 4 interceptions. Fisher decided to bench him after a win, a 9-6 slogfest against the Jets, deciding it was time to see what Goff could do. The answer was not very much. The Rams didn't win again, and after a 42-14 loss to the Falcons dropped their record to 4-9, Fisher was fired. The interim coach was John Fossil, son of former Giants coach Jim Fossil, who had once taken New York to the Super Bowl. The switch to Fossil changed little. The Rams, with Goff starting, lost out, ending the season by being routed 44-6 by the Cardinals at home before an announced crowd of 66,125 that looked a lot closer to 125 by the time the clock mercifully hit all zeros. Knowing that the Rams' new coaching staff wasn't going to bring him back, Keenum signed a 1-year deal with the Vikings in March worth $2 million. He was supposed to be an insurance policy for Sam Bradford and for Teddy Bridgewater, whose return from his shattered leg remained a huge question mark. Keenum at least had starting experience if something went wrong. And then it did. Bridgewater clearly wasn't close to coming back when the season began, and Bradford went down in Game 1. He came back for Game 4 and looked so bad that Coach Mike Zimmer quickly went back to Keenum. He never went back to Bradford again. Such is life in the NFL. 1 week after Aaron Rodgers had been injured, the Ravens limped into U.S. Bank Stadium. The limp was more figurative than literal. The loss to the Bears hadn't been crippling, but it had been damaging. The game wasn't exactly must-see TV or must-watch football. Once upon a time, the Vikings played their games in Metropolitan Stadium, which had been built primarily for baseball. In fact, the configuration of the stadium was so odd that the two teams shared the same sideline. During the years of Fran Tarkenton and the Purple People Eaters, the Vikings were almost unbeatable at home in late-season games because no one, with the possible exception of the Packers, knew what it was like to play in such cold conditions on a regular basis. In 1982, the Metrodome opened, and both the Twins and Vikings left Metropolitan Stadium. The Mall of America is now on the old stadium site to move indoors. The Vikings lost their cold weather edge in 2014 and 2015. While waiting for US Bank Stadium to be built, the Vikings played in